Welcome to Teamwork, A Better Way, the podcast filled with stories, experiences, and insights from leading high-performing team experts. Here are your hosts, Spencer Horn and Christian Napier.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, everyone. It's great to see you on another episode of Teamwork, A Better Way. I'm Christian Napier, joined by Spencer Horn. Spencer, how are you enjoying your May weather here in the Salt Lake?
I'm ready to go skiing. I was playing some Christmas music yesterday with that snowstorm we had. Wow, amazing. Did you get some snow out where you are?
We did, yeah. That was it was pretty awesome. We had a dinner, well, I guess it was a late lunch yesterday with my sister-in-law's family, and it was quite interesting because one of the guests was from the Netherlands.
Oh.
And so that was awesome. But seeing snow at this time of year was surprising, even for her, right? So it was really, really cool to have the snow at this
time
of year.
You got the flowers and the leaves out, and then we got this incredible snowstorm, and it was not insignificant. It was pretty hefty.
It was. It really bent over our trees and stuff, so we had to go knock the snow off them to make sure they wouldn't, you know, the boughs wouldn't break and stuff. But so it's an unusual start to May here in the Intermountain region, but May is also Mental Health Awareness Month, Spencer, and
yes.
Such an important topic. And I found this survey that was conducted by Mindshare Partners. The Harris Poll actually they commissioned the Harris Poll to determine the state of employee mental well-being. And wow, there's some revealing statistics in this report, Spencer, that I want to dive into.
Yeah.
And perhaps the most important one was, 35% of workers say that stress about their mental health impacts their ability to do their work. And this outranks any other element, whether it's job security, social issues, caregiving, and that nearly 4 out of 5 workers say that their work experience would be better if their employers said that they cared about their employees' mental well-being. What do you make of this?
I can understand that. And I don't know that, you know, I think the employers can say, hey, we care about it. But I think implicit in that number is the concern over just security, over the economy. I mean, we hear in the news every day, you know, the world economy is struggling. And obviously, we are experiencing huge inflation in really around the world, but here in the United States as well. And you couple that with the fact that, hey, I may not have a job a couple months from now. And I think the cry is, you know, let us know that you care about us and that everything's going to be okay. Because when you're thinking about the future, awfulizing and catastrophizing, I mean, it's really hard to focus on what's happening in the present. And productivity goes down. That can create a, self-fulfilling prophecy where the companies have to cut back. And I mean it's just... So they're not going to say, hey, we'll save you no matter what. I mean, the company exists for profit. And so there's this inherent tension. I know we didn't plan that, but that's just what comes to mind when you ask that.
Well, what's interesting also about that, Spencer, is not this survey is pointing out something that's happening right now. I mean, the survey was conducted about 2 weeks ago, right? So this is very fresh information. But the trend is also equally as interesting. So according to, I'm just reading my notes here, CompSych, who is the world's largest mental health employer or employee assistance provider, they recently published a report that showed that mental health related absences, so people not able to come to work, are up a third from just 2 years ago.
Yeah.
300% from 7 years ago in 2017, anxiety being the most commonly reported issue. So we're seeing this trend where mental health and anxiety and stress, it's really skyrocketing in the workplace.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And you know, job security is certainly only a small part of that. There's, I think, many factors that are attributing to that. So I think today, you know, I hope it will be helpful to our listeners for us to talk about it, to discuss why this is happening and maybe some ideas to help rectify the situation. If you're an employer, even if you're an employee, you have those of you who are feeling and experiencing anxiety and stress and mental health challenges, there are some things that you can do to control that. And it's not just on the employer's shoulders, I think, Christian, that this lies. I mean, they certainly can do some things to help. But when we all get involved, I think then we have a greater chance of addressing some of these numbers and seeing a decrease.
I agree. And I'll just put this caveat out there. Number one, we are not licensed mental health professional.
No.
We're not giving any kind of mental health advice here. Number two, the information that we share today isn't meant to help people or work with people who are suffering from serious mental health issues. Again, this is the domain of licensed professionals.
Mental health professionals. And there's so many differences between people's situations. I mean, general tools that we give you may not be perfectly applied, you know, depending on where you are in the world or your experience, your just what's happening with you. However, maybe these will spark some motivation for you to either get the help that you need or do some of your own research and get some of the tools that will help you immediately.
That's exactly right, Spencer. And so what we can do is we can speak to our own experience.
Yes.
And what we're seeing as we're working in our own organizations or working in advising other organizations, that we can, I think we can corroborate anecdotally the statistics that are borne out in this report. We're seeing massive increase in people feeling anxiety, feeling a lot of stress in the workplace. We've seen that increase quite a bit. There are a number of reasons for that. I mean, COVID comes and kind of completely disrupts everything. There are a lot of geopolitical instabilities. You mentioned inflation. So there are a lot of external factors that are contributing this. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, Spencer, is, and we talked about this a little bit before we came on air, in some cases, I think there's a bit of a paradox, or we're in a bit of a conundrum, because we are raising the awareness of mental health. You know, here we have Mental Health Awareness Month, for example, that by raising awareness, we're putting a focus on it, we're putting a lens on it, and there's naturally some things happen when you put lenses on them like this. And we've seen that throughout history where there's been some type of a global issue that's been spotlighted, I don't know the appropriate word, by the media or by industry or whatever. And when you put that lens on it, it becomes the thing that dominates conversation and we start to attribute a lot of things to it. And sometimes I wonder if paradoxically, by placing such a focus on mental health and mental well-being, we're actually inadvertently exacerbating the problem because we are just pounding it in everybody's heads all the time.
I think that is a good observation, partly because of how the brain works. And one of the suggestions that I'm going to give to help with just the stress of the things that cause anxiety, and we'll talk about those in a minute, actually uses that brain's focus to redirect it away from those things that are causing stress. So it's true, the expectancy theory, you know, the Heisenberg principle, when you expect something and by putting a spotlight on it, then it shows up. I mean, you know, in psychology, when you observe test takers, you change the outcome of the results. You have to you know, have to observe them in isolation to not influence or bias the results in any way. But by talking about mental health, there is a paradox of perhaps biasing our focus on that. You know, and that's not to diminish the importance of talking about it. We actually need to talk about it. But at the same time, that does create potentially a paradox of more people looking for something than before. Or we're just now highlighting it and it was there all along. But I do believe that just what's happening in society in the last several years have certainly added to the problem. And one of those we'll get into is technology. And I think that's a big part of the problem. And it's something certainly new since the early 2000s.
Well, maybe we should talk about that, Spencer. You're right. We've had technology. When I say technology, people often think about computers and those kind of things, the internet and so on and so forth. And 20 years ago, the internet was just coming into being. And the only way that you could really access the internet was through a desktop or laptop computer. So since then, we had the advent of smartphones, of social media, and these devices and applications have become pervasive, where maybe 20 years ago you might have had people interacting with devices primarily at work to do work, or at home maybe they were playing video games or something like this. But this has just introduced a whole new realm of opportunities for mental health to be for us to be whacked in the head, when it comes to mental health. So why don't you talk about the technology a little bit? And what you're saying.
I absolutely want to do that. Can I maybe just give a brief paragraph of what mental health is first, so that we understand how, and then we'll That's go right into that technology. Yeah. Mental health refers, and I'm going to read this, to a person's overall psychological and emotional well-being. It encompasses various aspects of life, including how individuals think, feel, behave, and as well as how they cope with stress, relate to others, and make choices. Good mental health allows individuals to function effectively in their daily lives, manage challenges, build positive relationships, and contribute to their communities. It is important to note that mental health is not just the absence of mental illness, but also involves resilience, self-esteem, and a sense of purpose and fulfillment. And taking care of one's mental health is essential in maintaining a balanced and fulfilling life. And I think it's important that we understand that we need to address things like resilience and meaning and purpose and fulfillment in well-being. We'll come back to that. You and I, we got to attend a conference recently together, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And I spoke about that at the conference. But I think one of the challenges that we're having today is a focus on hyper productivity. We are trying to get so much more done in less time, and hence the rise of artificial intelligence. Why? Because for the last many years, finding qualified people to fill jobs has been a struggle for some industries are still struggling to find qualified labor. And so there has been a resulting focus on how do we make up for this shortfall. And we have created apps, machines. I mean, I just watched a cabbage machine harvesting cabbages that removes 15 people from the job. But not only that, I use every day, Christian, and I know you do too, I use artificial intelligence in apps and even preparing for today, managing my time, managing my diet, managing my exercise, I'm getting notifications on my watch while we're having this conversation. I have my board of directors from my from my association that I'm president-elect for are messaging me while I'm here talking to you. And I can notice that while that's happening. So I am actually multitasking, doing more things, expending more energy because of this hyper-focus on productivity. And in order to manage all this, I have apps all over the place. On my phone, there are hundreds of them. And I imagine people listening have the same. And part of that is driven by desire for profit. People make these devices to they raise money and they come up with an idea and then they sell it to the marketplace and we buy it with the promise of being more productive. But then we get into this addiction, literally, of high performance, and we're exhausted. I mean, we can do the work of four or five people now, and we have to. Well, that's not great for our mental health and well-being.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit more, Spencer, because you're right. In the past, and I don't want to, when I talk about the past, I don't want to paint like a super rosy picture. Well, back in the day, you know, everything was lovely, because it wasn't. I mean, we had real problems back in the day, and our forebears did as well. But as you mentioned, individual workers are being asked to take on more and more responsibilities because the technologies now exist that allow that to happen, right? And not only are we taking on more responsibility, we are taking on different responsibilities, right? So you as a small business owner, not only are doing the core elements of the business, and you know you're spending time crafting keynotes and workshops and things, but you don't hire a technical writer. You are your own technical writer. You are the editor. You are the person who books the flights. You know, used to be people couldn't even do that if you wanted to. I mean, you had to contact travel agents to do that kind of work, and now we do all this work ourselves. So you're the travel agency, you're the technical writer, you're the presenter, you're the scheduler. You assume more responsibilities because technology allows you to do it, whereas in the past you couldn't. You had to rely on other people, and you know, that just increases stress more, because not only do I have more work, but I have different kinds of work that I have to become expert at. Just like this conversation today, you're over there with Ecamm and you got your A10 Mini and you're pushing buttons and you're the producer and you're the editor and you're the host. And
I'm creating video content. Luckily, I have someone to do my accounting and edit helps me. Somebody, my wife is my business partner, helps me edit. But I do have some help, but it's still, you're right. I didn't even think about that. Here I have this Stream Deck. I have this A10 Mini. I've got I had to learn this new technology because I got a, what do you call it? A monitor where, you know, you can read and put a script on.
A teleprompter.
I had to figure out how to operate that. I've used it maybe twice in my life, but, you know, so I have to figure all this out. Why? Because it takes me less time to be able to produce some of the content when I don't have to memorize everything in a second, which I've done for many years. So I got some technology to help me produce that faster, but I had to learn that, and that took some time. But now I can use it. And but it is, you're right. I mean, we're constantly learning and evolving, and it's hard. But there are some serious negative side effects to the use of this technology. And one of those is addiction, which is really messing with our mental health. This is an incredible book that I want to highlight here called Irresistible by Adam Alter, The Rise of Addictive Technology and the Business of Keeping Us Hooked. And it says, we are so focused on getting more done in less time, we've forgotten to introduce an emergency break. And it's interesting because it's easy to hide behavioral addictions rather than like addiction to alcohol and those things. But what we're finding is that technology is more addictive than alcohol, drugs, or anything that humans have ever experienced. So much so that the people that create this stuff, like Steve Jobs, would not even allow their own kids to have iPads. Because you know what they say, you know, if you're a drug dealer, you don't smoke your own supply. So these computer programmers are setting, are creating programs that are purposely designed to hook us into addiction, to stay hooked up, to keep us on the app. You know, we get these likes and these little dopamine bursts every time that we do it. But that creates some serious problems. And I want to read a little bit out of this book here. Now, this was published in 2017, so it's, you know, 7 years now out of date. Some of these addictions continue to grow with technological innovation and social change. One recent study, recent from this book 7 years ago, suggests that up to 40% of the population suffers from some form of internet-based addiction, whether to email. Some of you listening are addicted to email. You have to look at your inbox all the time. Gaming or pornography. Another found that 48% of its sample of U.S. university students were internet addicts. Another 40% were borderline potential addicts. So here's a little internet addiction test. Should we do it?
Let's do it.
Okay. I want you to select a response for, okay, these are the answers. 0, not applicable. 1 is rarely. 2 is occasionally. 3 is frequently. 4 is often, and 5 is always. So it's a scale from 0 to 5, okay? So the question is, and I'm going to answer this with you. Shall we do it together?
Let's do it.
How often do you find that you stay online longer than you intended? I'd say that's 4 or 5 for me.
Yeah, the same. I would say the same.
I'd say 4.5.
I mean, it's just part of, you know, I have to be online to do my work.
Yeah, but I'm online longer than I want to. I get on to look at Instagram to check, you know, check if I have any comments for my posts, and I end up, you know, 20 minutes later, I'm like, what the heck just happened? That happens a lot.
Yeah, you know what happens for me is I want to keep my home screen free of little red bubbles that have numbers in them that show.
So you're going to give us a solution.
Yeah. And so what do? Like, oh, I got to get rid of that thing, which means I need to read it, you know, or I need to at least open it and then, you know.
So that's one of the ways that we get addicted is we get a notification that there's something important out there that we need to check on. Those are the little notifications, right?
That's right.
Excellent. Okay. Question number 2.
I said it's a big issue for me. I got to keep my screen clean.
How often do others in your life complain to you about the amount of time you spend online?
I really don't get any complaints about that. So when I'm in conversation with other people, I try to refrain from.
Good for you. I get that. I'd say that's a 3, maybe a 2.5. Same thing when I'm in conversations with people, but I do hear from my wife, you know, put down the phone, because like if I'm not interested in the movie or show we're watching, I'll be looking at my phone or something like that. So I'll get that occasionally. So far I'm going to say I'll call it a 7. How often do you check your email before something else that you need to do?
It's pretty often. I'd probably say a 4 on that one.
I'd say that's a 4 for me too. Unfortunately. And you know, it's, and I know better. Okay. So now I'm up to 11. How often do you lose sleep because of late night logins? I'm going to say that's a 1 for me.
Yeah. I don't, I hit the pillow and within 5 minutes I'm out.
Yeah. The only thing is if I'm looking at something before bed, I try not to do that. It's actually one of my, you know, the mental health suggestions, but you know, I'm trying to read analog books before bed, so I'm getting off the screen, but sometimes I'm reading reading something that I want to read on my phone. But so I'm going to say that is a one for me. So I'm where am I at? 12? I can't keep track.
I think I'm around 10 or 11.
Okay. How often do you find yourself just saying just a few minutes when online?
Fairly often. I
Yeah.
will say that often, but usually for me, and I'm not trying to make excuses, but usually that's a work-related thing, right?
Yeah. So I'm gonna say three for me. So that takes me to 15. Okay. If you scored seven or below, you show no signs of internet addiction. A score of 8 to 12 suggests mild internet addiction. You may spend too long on the web sometimes, but you're generally in control of your usage. A 13 to 20 indicates moderate internet addiction. All right, I'm moderately internet addicted.
I'm around 14.
Yeah, if you are at 21 to 25, suggests severe internet addiction and implies that internet is causing significant problems in your life. Was that helpful?
Yeah, I think that pretty much nailed it for me.
Yeah, and so the book is really amazing. I mean, there's so much in there. And so while we're on it, let's talk about, I want to talk a little bit about some potential solutions. And it really starts at birth. I see parents giving their kids phones and iPads just to keep, to shut them up. And we're literally addicting our children to technology from babies. And he did. There's some research that was done for teenagers that were, well, let's see. Oh, I'm just going to share one study that they did of 51 children visited a summer camp just outside of Los Angeles. This is in 2012. The children were typical Southern California public school kids, mix of boy and girls, and they addicted to half of them owned a phone. Now today, all of them would own a phone. They'd spend an hour texting friends each day and about 2.5 hours watching TV, and just over an hour playing computer games. Okay, that's probably sounds pretty normal. So for the 1 week that they go to camp, they have to give up their phones, their TVs, all of that. And when they got to camp, they give them this interesting test. When the kids arrived at camp, they took a short test called the DANVA2, which stands for Diagnostic Analysis of Nonverbal Behavior. It's a fun test, right? And it's one of those that goes viral on Facebook because you have to interpret the emotional states of a bunch of strangers. And are they sad? Are they angry? Are they whatever it is. And the kids, when they get to camp, made an average of 14 errors across the 48-item test. After they had been hiking, camping, they were ready to go home. Before they did, the researchers administered the DANVA2 test again, and they reasoned that a week of face-to-face interaction without distraction from gadgets might make the kids more sensitive to emotional cues. And what it turns out is that their error rate dropped 33% just by being away from their technology. I think one of the reasons that we are less resilient and emotionally aware and mentally fit today is that we're addicted to our devices that cause us to see things that we don't have, to see people going places and doing things that we're not at. We're comparing ourselves to them. We are addicted to our technology because it's designed to addict us so that we stay hooked. And oftentimes, when you're addicted to something, you feel bad about yourself because, like, I should have more willpower. I should have more self-control. I mean, I'm 59 years old, Christian. I should have more self-control than to be mildly internet addicted.
I think that's true. You and I both, right? I think we definitely should. One thing that I find interesting about this, Spencer, is not only are we becoming addicted to this, and our addiction is reflected in the amount of time that we spend on these,
Yeah.
but you started to allude to it, the other impacts it has on us. So this study pointed out children's inability to effectively detect emotion and things from other people, right? Because they're used to seeing people on screens and not necessarily seeing them in real life. And so when you kind of separate the two, there's a problem. And what that tells me is this brain of ours is kind of like a muscle, and we have to train that muscle if we want the muscle to be healthy. If we want our brains to be healthy, we have to consume content and experiences that will positively contribute to our own mental health, and we have to exercise our mental faculties to increase our resilience. And what I'm hearing you say is the technologies that we're addicted to are lowering our ability to ability to be mentally fit because we're not exercising these muscles, right?
No, that's absolutely right. I am saying that, and I think that happiness comes when we are connected emotionally with people, and we're doing meaningful work. We're not just we're actually turning ourselves into robots because we're so much online. So I want to share a couple of techniques, or at least one, to help with this, because what I've found and what research has found is that abstinence and willpower alone doesn't work. You can't just say, all right, I'm gonna kick this habit and I'm gonna be disciplined from now on. Because if you're addicted to something, just thinking about the thing that you want to not be addicted to causes you to think about it. Kind of what we were talking about with mental illness in the first place. Our minds were focused on it, right? Anybody who's listening right now, I want you to not think about chocolate ice cream for the next 30 seconds. Wiggle your little finger if you think about chocolate ice cream in the next 30 seconds. Don't think about it.
That's all I can think about now is chocolate
ice cream. Why? Because I've planted that thought in your mind. Again, that's how our brains work, is when you're thinking about something. I mean, they studied in China people who were addicted to Facebook, and they'd say, just, don't look at Facebook for 3 days. But the more people thought about not looking at it, the more they realized they wanted it, and so it was really hard for them not to do it. So instead of that, what you get to do is that you have to understand addiction. There's a cue, there's a response, and then there's an action, and then there's a reward. And so you gotta understand there's going to be a cue or a desire, to smoke a cigarette, to look at social media, to pick up your phone. Literally, to pick up your phone is an action, because I'm feeling the need to look at my technology. And then the reward is I get a dopamine burst because I check my little buttons and see if I missed anything, right? So the way to beat that is to replace the action, to substitute something for the action. And they've done research, and they have like dummy phones that can see through, but you pick up the phone, you can actually see the real world, not looking at the screen. But something that allows you to pick up something and feel that thing in your hands. We have missionaries from our church. These are young kids, 18, 19 years old, that go on missions. They've been addicted to their phones. And so one of the ways they get rid of that addiction is they give them little wooden blocks to hold on to. Think about smoking addicts. What do? They give them nicotine gum. And over time, they reduce the nicotine because, the touching of the fingers to the cigarette is the cue that I'm going to get a hit of nicotine. And so if you replace that with chewing or a piece of gum or something, that's enabling you to replace the action of, instead of puffing on the cigarette, but you still get a little bit of that reward. And I think that's one of the keys that we have to do, is figure out how to replace whatever is we're addicted to with something, whether it be a squeezy ball, if you have to check your email. I teach productivity to a lot of the managers that I work with, and I suggest something called time blocking. Only check your emails at certain intervals throughout the day. And turn off your notifications. I turn off my notifications on LinkedIn, on Facebook, even on my email, I turn off the notifications. And I only go in and check them when I am ready. Now, that's still more than I want it to be, but I'm in control of that. And I consciously go and I check my my social media and my emails at intervals throughout the day. And that really, really helps. Another thing that helps is don't start young. My daughter and her husband have been fantastic. They have four kids. Their oldest is 13 years old. All of her friends have smartphones and social media. It is such a mistake to give your kids that technology so young. And it's hard because everybody else has it. And our 13-year-old daughter doesn't have it. And she, you know, can't email on her friends. She can email her family. She can't get on the internet. And if she wants to email group email, she has to get on her mom's phone. But you know what? Now that they've gotten past the uncomfortable conversations, like, Mom, everybody else has it. She is so well adjusted now. She's focused on other things, books and readings and learning and activities and crafts and hobbies. She has time for it. And she is completely oblivious now that it's even a problem, because she got over that initial comparison fear. And she's doing so well. She's thriving, and her friends know how awesome she is, and so they don't care. But it's hard in the beginning to remove yourself from that. So those are a couple of ideas to help you. But my suggestion is, read this. We don't have time to go into all the suggestions, but read that book, Irresistible. There's a lot of things that we can learn from it.
Spencer, I want to pivot away from the technology here for a moment. Yes. To address other things that are pointed out in the survey. One of those was that about 1 in 2 working Americans that are full-time employed are anxious about their job security.
Yeah.
Right? So in addition to that, almost 90% of them are very interested in finding more work-life balance, and 86% are citing that if they had more autonomy and flexibility to get their work done, you know, those kinds of actions that employers could take would make their overall work experience better. So the technology, the addiction is a massive component of this, but in addition to that, there are some other factors that play into it, and one of those is the unpredictability of our work environment these days. And so what could people do, both employers and employees, to help to reduce the level of anxiety that people, workers, are feeling about their jobs, the security of their jobs?
That's a good question, Christian. I don't know if I have the answer. You know, I work for myself. I'm self-employed, and I've been in the shoes where I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to have a job. Well, I'm unemployed every single day if I don't go out and find a client to work with, but yet it gives me so much more confidence to know that I have in my own control the ability to go out and secure my future. I am not reliant on an employer. I am certainly reliant on the economy. But what I've found in the past is that I can get through that, and I've navigated through that through effort and predictable actions that bring a resultant reward. When you're just trading time for dollars, it's hard to do that. So I don't know. I think maybe it's having a conversation with your boss, with your employer, about what's coming and what can I do to make sure that I bring the most value to the organization right now to help through any downturn. I remember going to my boss, Kelvin, who I've talked about, after our failed fundraiser. I mean, we had a big stock offering that failed because of the hurricane that hit where we were going to build our next project. And as a result, we didn't raise the money. And so I went to Kelvin and I said, Kelvin, should I be looking for another job? I know that's not a conversation that's gonna be helping. He says, yeah, you probably should. And so he gave me the time to do that, and I found another job. But that's kind of a relationship that I think if you have with your employer, that I think is very productive. Were there things that I could have said, hey, Kelvin, what can I do to help make sure that we get through this tough time? That's a conversation I could have had as well. But I had an opportunity, and so I said, would it help if I pursued this other opportunity? He said, yes. So I don't know that I know the answer. What do you think about that?
Well, I think number one, that it's similar to the mental health awareness in that anytime there's any kind of a layoff, right, it becomes very prominent in the news. So we heard, you know, about all the tech layoffs that happened before. And so that just the knowledge that a lot of the instability is out there just makes us feel anxious anyway, even if our own specific situation may not necessarily be at risk at this time, but we might not feel secure right. in our own environment because of all the instability that there is in the world that we're hearing about constantly through the devices that we're using that right. is telling us all the time about these instabilities. So I think part of it is because it's front of mind, because it's always hitting us in the face, we feel anxious about our job security. In terms of what to do about it, I think, you know, one of the things that we can do, probably one of the most important things we can do, whether we're self-employed or whether we have full-time jobs, is to make sure that we are networked, you know, so build relationships, whether it's with clients, stakeholders, peers in the industry, whatever it is, so that when the hurricane comes, so to speak, like you were talking about, you have some options, you know. So I think that's one thing that people can do is proactively look to build out their networks so that if they've got a resilient network, then, you know, if an unforeseen event happens, they can rely on that network to help them find other opportunities, whether they're, you know, full-time career opportunities or whether they are, as you mentioned, being a small business owner, self-employed individual, you know, finding other clients. You have to do that, right? If you lose one account, you've got to replace it with another and so on and so forth. So if you're well-networked, then you're in a better position to do that.
I love that suggestion. I think that's an incredible suggestion. And learn how to create relationships both online and offline. I think there's also lots of things that can be done to manage stress personally. And if it's okay, can I suggest a few of those things? Something as simple as learning how to breathe effectively. There are breathing techniques. One of those is box breathing, where you breathe in for four counts, hold for four counts, exhale for four counts, and then hold for four counts and repeat that. Do that mindfully, regularly, and it will refocus your mind. Literally, the oxygen in your brain will release the stress and the tension and help you to think more clearly. There's meditation techniques that are very, very helpful. Regular exercise is helpful. You know, we had Meredith on the show here before, and she travels all over the world, as do I. She says she never misses a workout. And whether that's playing tennis or golf or something to prepare her mentally and physically. When you exercise, you get a cognitive boost for about 20 hours. And I find that's true for me. If I'm preparing a talk, I'm actually doing it while I'm exercising. And it's just so important to keep your body healthy. good lifestyle choices, diet and getting enough sleep, limit caffeine. I've had to cut out caffeine in my life because of, you know, some of the things that are going on with my health, alcohol consumption, reduce those kinds of things. And, you know, those are really, really important to reduce stress naturally. Time management. Part of what I talked about before is learning how to do time boxing. Like I try to schedule my day where I do my, you know, my hardest tasks in the morning when I'm freshest or when I need to solve a problem. I will check my email on times when I'm, you know, after lunch or, you know, a certain time during the morning, but I don't do that all the time. So just check your email at certain times and prioritize your activities. And I think that's really important, because if you're replacing important things with, you know, the need to look at, hey, I've got us on the screen there. That's a replacement for an addictive behavior. Mindfulness activities. We've actually had podcast. We had early in January, we had a great hostess, who had a guest who talked about how to do some mindfulness activities. I think that was back in January. I'm meeting with her today as well to talk about some of her techniques. Let's see her. Let me see if we can tell our name of who that was. Because you could go back and listen to that. I think it was Anna Chamberlain. Yes, Chamberlain?
All right. Yeah.
So go back and listen to that on mindfulness activity. She had some great suggestions. You know, you talked about networking for business. Social support, networking for social and mental well-being is important too. Do you have friends that you can rely on when you're anxious and frustrated and want to talk about something? I mean, you and Patrick and I, we regularly meet and we talk about challenges that we're experiencing. We talk about fun things. We eat some great Mexican food, and it's healthy, right? I mean, I think it's good for us.
Yes, I'm going to keep telling myself that the food is extremely healthy, so I keep eating it. But the dialogue, the conversation is equally as healthy. You know, one thing that I want to add to your list, Spencer, because I think those are all excellent suggestions, is just making sure that you keep the communication open.
Yeah.
Because, you know, what did we see? What have we seen in the workplace as trends over the last couple of years, right? We had what was called colloquially the Great Resignation following COVID, right? Then we had all of these tech layoffs, you know, so we heard a lot about that. But then the trend shifted to quiet quitting, right? Yeah. Where, oh, I'm not really telling anybody. I'm just like slowly pulling myself away from my employer. And so we heard about this quiet quitting. And now what I'm hearing, and you might be able to corroborate this in your own experiences, is we're now seeing the opposite of quiet quitting, which are quiet layoffs, right? They're not being announced, but companies are just slowly reducing force, right? They are, you know, getting rid of people without any fanfare. They're not putting out a release. They're not holding any kind of a company meeting saying they're going to do this. They're just starting to let people go. You know, and what is happening? It's creating a lot of anxiety in the workplace because people aren't talking, you know? And when you don't talk, you make assumptions. And most of the time, those assumptions are bad assumptions, right? So you have employees that are making assumptions about what their employers are doing or are intending to do. And you have employers who aren't trusting their employees because their employees aren't talking to them. And it creates a lot of anxiety. I think if we were just more open and transparent with one another in our communication between employer and employee, things would be better, you know. And I understand why it's been done the way it's done. It's like, well, you know, we announced these layoffs and it, you know, created a big uproar and people were all anxious and everything. But what's happening now is they're doing it. It's not being announced. And what's happening in the workplace? Rumors, right? Rumors are circulating all over the place. Well, so-and-so is not here anymore. Why aren't they here? Well, I heard that they were let go. Oh, well, is that going to happen to me? They didn't even say anything. They just all of a sudden, these three people are gone. And why are they gone? I don't know. Nobody talked about it. And so we're becoming more anxious. It's actually exacerbating the problem instead of making it better. And where, okay, maybe it's more uncomfortable or initially if we make our intentions known and we announce it, but at least people have an expectation. Now we're just floating around in an ocean of uncertainty, not knowing what's going to be happening one day to the next.
So right. I actually have a client that had one of their key people quit, and CEO didn't talk about it for a couple of weeks. And in the absence of information, people will make up their own story. That's the awfulizing and the catastrophizing. So I think a couple other things I want to add to that list, if I can. Set boundaries for yourself. Turn off the work when you leave work. You've got to be able to create, I work at home, but I have a physical office. And so the office is the place where I do the work. When I leave that, I don't want to be doing work in the living room or, sometimes I'll check my email if I'm on the couch, but I want to create a physical demarcation of this is work, that's home. And I think you need to set some of those boundaries to help prevent burnout. And that can help with a little bit of the work-life balance that you asked me about a minute ago. I haven't answered you completely on that. Have hobbies, have life, have leisure activities that you love. And then lastly, get professional help if you need it. We already talked about that, but I think that's important. When it comes to work-life balance, Christian, I think we have not done ourselves any favors by saying, you need to have it, you need to have it. And usually life is out of balance. When you're at work, you're completely at work. When you're at home, you're at home. And when you're on vacation, you're on vacation. The key is to, sometimes you're going to be out of balance. Sometimes you've got a big project at work that you need to focus on, so you're going to be out of balance. Sometimes, like my son just had a baby, it'll be 3 weeks tomorrow. Well, his life was out of balance. He wasn't working. He was at home. And that's out of balance, right? But that's where he needed to be for that time. There are seasons, and I think we set ourselves up with kind of Disney-like thinking that everything will be happily ever after if we have a job that we love what we're doing, and there's no then we're not working. No, that's one of the reasons why we don't have resilience anymore, because we have these false expectations that life is going to be easy. When we expect things to, it's called work for a reason. We are working, and work is hard inherently. And so if we are mentally prepared for work to be hard, I think our resilience increases and we're not disappointed as much. And I think one of the things that helps with work-life balance is to plan times when you're going to be away from work, whether that's bowling on the weekend or going to see a movie or a weekend getaway or even a family vacation. Get it on the calendar all the time, so you always have something to look forward to. Because when you're pushing through that imbalance, you can say, "Hey, I have hope for the fact that I'm going to spend time with my significant other or my friends, and we're going to do something tonight or we're going to do something this weekend. I can get through to the weekend." And I think that's something that will help. Gosh, there's so much more to cover. I want to see if there's anything that just a gosh, there's oh boy.
Yeah, there's a lot still in the study that we didn't cover. One thing that I think would be interesting just touch on before we call it a day here, Spencer.
Yes.
So there's been opposition to diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, and people are kind of reframing those. But employers ensuring fairness and equality at work, according to the survey, is a key factor and a high priority. 84% of workers mention that as a priority. And then politics, which I find the results of this particular part of the survey fascinating. So you've got 80% of full-time employees want their employers to be politically neutral.
Neutral.
That makes sense. Politically neutral. But 59%, so almost 6 out of 10, would find it favorable if their company speaks up on social issues, even controversial ones. Yeah. So I see this as a bit of a contradiction, but maybe there's some nuance in there that I'm missing where, on the one hand, we want our employers to be politically neutral because that's comfortable for us. We don't have to deal with it. But at the same time, 60% would like companies to that they work for to speak up on social issues, even if they're controversial. This skews toward younger people, right? So younger full-time employees, 62%, compared to those in our age bracket, only 43% would want our companies to speak out on social issues. So what are your thoughts about the DEI?
My opinion is there are so many people around the world and here at home that can use our help. And I think as an organization, for example, you know, right now in the United States and many places around the world, the Gaza Israeli crisis is very political in nature. Yet feeding and caring for the refugees, I think, is a nonpartisan issue. So I think if a company got involved and say, hey, let's figure out how to support refugees in Poland from Ukraine or in Gaza or wherever they are, let's help those in need. Now we're not talking about divest this or, you know, punish them or, you know, do this or do that. It's let's help people in need. I think there are causes that you can get involved in as a, you know, as an organization and groups within an organization that are purpose and cause centered and not political. So I think I think that's a great idea for companies to do is let's make a difference and figure out. Some companies actually ask their employees, you know, which cause do you want us to raise money for this time? And they rotate that. And they, you know, they'll donate to certain causes locally and abroad. To, you know, I know that my National Speakers Association, we got a grant for a nonprofit that I'm involved in called Empower Mali. And this specific grant was for technology. And we got iPads for kids in schools in Mali. And, you know, so there's so many things that you can do. And there's grants and there's fundraisers that you can do to do good in the world that is, you know, separated from politics. I think just help. And that's another thing that I think really helps, Christian. A lot of times when we're focused on mental health, we need to focus on ourselves. But I think that's also part of the problem. And there's balance in everything. We really have to manage these contraries. If we focus too much on ourselves, we actually exacerbate the mental health problems. And as soon as we start turning outward and help those that are in need, I'm not talking about just demonstrating. I'm talking about go and help your neighbor. Go take someone that's lonely. I just was texting somebody this morning and they're lonely. What can I do to help them feel like they have a friend? What can I do? Not go out and hold up a sign, hey, you know, let's end loneliness. Let's go out and actually be somebody's friend. Let's go take them to lunch. Let's have conversations. Let's get off our phones and go put our arms around people like you and I do with Patrick. Let's start focusing on others. And the more that we're service-minded towards others and helping them with their problems, it seems like our problems, they don't go away, but they seem smaller.
We can put things in perspective, right? When we have that benchmark and we serve another person and we understand their circumstance, I think that's fantastic, Spencer. And maybe we leave it there. It's been a wonderful hour of conversation. And Spencer, you have served so many, you've helped so many organizations and you've helped so many individuals. But if people want to learn about how you can help them to create high-performing teams in their organizations, what's the best way for them to connect with you?
You know, message me on LinkedIn. I get messages every day and I'll always respond. So I even respond to people that I shouldn't, that are Most of the time I can tell if they're a scam or not, but if you're sincere, I will definitely respond to you. How about you, Christian? You have all of your experience, and I was introducing people to you when I was speaking at the conference last week and called you out, and you had all kinds of people come up to you for advice and networking and connections. How can I get a hold of you?
Working on Olympic Games. I appreciate you making those connections, Spencer. Same, just reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm happy to connect with you and let's strike up a conversation. Okay, Spencer. Well, another episode in the books. Hopefully by the next episode, the sun will be out and we'll be enjoying some really beautiful spring weather. Listeners, yeah. Viewers, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Please like and subscribe to our podcast. We'll catch you again soon.
Hey, this was our 130th.
Woohoo! That's awesome.
See ya.